Top 100 project
and action.
Good evening, and thanks for investing time in the Top 100 Project, the podcast that looks back at the AFI's 1998 and 2007 lists of the 100 greatest American movies. Caution, weary travelers, spoilers will be bandied about from here on out. I'm Ryan Ellis with my blonde double agent spy of a wife, Bev.
That's me.
All right, the coming attractions trivia for this week's film, North by Northwest. Which two Hitchcock films ranked ahead of North by Northwest in the mystery category of the Top 100 Genres list? And the bonus to this is, what was his fourth film in that category?
Vertigo?
Mm-hmm.
Is number one, isn't it?
Number one, yep.
Yeah, and it's got to be Rear Window. Mm-hmm.
Number three.
Is Psycho even on that list?
Nope, because it's not a mystery. So, although, well, it is a mystery, but it's not considered a mystery film.
Is Chinatown it Notorious? Is the other film?
No. Chinatown was number two, not a Hitchcock film, but that was the order. Vertigo, Chinatown, Rear Window, and so on. The other film was Dial M for Murder.
Oh, right, of course.
Okay, the Top 100 Project's 56th motion picture, North by Northwest, was 40th on the 1998 list between Dr. Zhivago and West Side Story, then fell to 55th in 2007 between MASH and Jaws. North by Northwest had a glitzy Hollywood premiere on July 17, 1959, then was released by MGM on August the 6th. To call this film a success is an understatement. People loved it and paid lots of bucks to check it out. Bev will tell you what it's all about with a skinny.
Cary Grant is Roger Thornhill, a Manhattan advertising executive who's mistaken for a government agent by foreign spies who are looking for a top-secret microfilm. Roger hastily travels west and somewhat north across America, hooking up with the mysterious Eve Kendall, played by Eva Marie Saint. The bad guys, James Mason and Martin Landau, are hot on Roger's heels.
Or in a nutshell, National Monument trampled during skirmish over clandestine files. Poor Lincoln, poor Jefferson, poor Washington, and poor Roosevelt.
Mm-hmm.
There's some useless trivia for people who don't know who the four faces are on Mount Rushmore.
Who doesn't know who the four faces are?
A lot of people probably don't know that.
Yeah, I guess.
And by the way, this is the rare film, any film, AFI or otherwise, that starts or ends in South Dakota.
Poor South Dakota.
I guess.
Do you know who's even worse off than South Dakota? North Dakota. They don't even have Mount Rushmore, man.
I guess Nebraska last year. Bruce Dern film.
Right.
They go to see it and he's not impressed. Bruce Dern's character is not impressed. But very few films ever go there. All right, North by Northwest, your thoughts?
I liked this one. It's so relentlessly fun. I'm still not Hitchcock's biggest fan, but there's no denying this film is just a blast to watch. Every chance he has to delight the audience, he takes, and the effect is a funny, suspenseful, charming film. Not my favorite film by a long shot, but my favorite Hitchcock film, for sure.
You've seen the three we've done.
Mm-hmm.
You've seen Psycho.
I've seen the Gus Van Sant remake of
Oh,
Psycho.
Right, you have not seen the original.
Yeah,
okay.
And I've seen The Birds, and I think that wraps up every Hitchcock movie.
Not Notorious, though. Which
No, I've never seen Notorious.
See. Yeah, and Strangers on a Train, or Shadow of a Doubt.
Nope.
What do you think about the rankings? 40th to 55th, a pretty big drop.
I'm disappointed that it's lower than the other Hitchcock films, because I honestly think it's a superior film.
Hmm.
It doesn't have the flaws his other films have, and his flaws mainly being that they're boring. They're so boring.
I don't agree about Rear Window, as we said back during that podcast. And I don't even agree that Vertigo is boring, but I know that you and other people have your issues with some of the longer stretches in that movie where not much is really happening.
Mm-hmm.
And it may be repetitive and all those things we talked about a few weeks ago on Vertigo. But this one is very tongue-in-cheek. And Hitchcock and Ernest Lehman, the writer, they knew that going in. They knew their story was ludicrous.
Yeah.
This is the ultimate Hitchcock MacGuffin, the microfilm.
Mm-hmm.
Because it barely seems like anybody in the movie even cares about
it. They never even say what's in the microfilm that anybody should care about.
Yeah.
It's irrelevant.
I think we've talked about MacGuffin. People must know this if they're classic movie fans. It just means something that Hitchcock came up with, apparently, this word. It's something that everybody in the movie is after, but it doesn't really matter what it is.
Like, a classic MacGuffin would be this, or the Maltese Falcon is another thing. As long as you believe that the characters want it, then it doesn't matter if it's actually valuable or not.
And I mentioned Ernest Lehman. He and Hitchcock wanted to make the ultimate Hitchcock film. At least Lehman wanted to do that. And they may have done it. They also did a Bond film before there were Bond films.
Yeah, it's considered the first Bond film. Not officially, but...
Not literally, no.
But it was suave, smooth-talking guy in a sharp suit... a lady killer who goes around and ends up thwarting spies all by himself.
I don't like Bond. He doesn't travel the whole world, but he does travel across a large swath of America. There's he starts out in New York. He ends up in different parts of New York. Long Island is where he ends up in that mansion. He goes to Chicago. He obviously ends up in South Dakota. Now, people probably wonder what the hell this title means. Some of the titles we've had through the entire project don't mean anything, or if they do, we've tried to explain what they mean during the podcast. This one, North by Northwest, apparently refers to a line in Hamlet where he says, "I am but mad north, northwest."
Yeah.
Also, there is a plane in the background towards the end where Cary Grant is meeting up with the professor, who explains what's happening, all this whole plot, what Eve's role is in the whole thing, what they're all doing, that says Northwest, so it's Northwest Airlines.
Mm-hmm.
And the North apparently was going to refer to them going to, in the climax, Alaska.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
So that's what that refers to. Mm-hmm. We've got to go north by Northwest Airlines. And also, in the end, I guess kind of like Reservoir Dogs and many other titles, it doesn't really mean anything. Who really cares?
They said in the end, when somebody asked them why they stuck with that name, they never really came up with a better one.
Kind of like the end of Some Like It Hot, the line, "Nobody's Perfect." Billy Wilder and I.A.L. Diamond couldn't come up with a better line, stayed in there, became classically famous in North by Northwest. Same kind of issue here.
It was originally going to be called The Man in Lincoln's Nose. At the end, the climax was meant to be somebody in his nose and then who actually sneezes and gives away their position. But they decided it was too disrespectful, and so they cut that scene, and they had to rename the film.
And even Hitchcock realized that. I don't know, Hitchcock may have just been joking about that. He was a classic joker. He maybe never intended that to be the title.
But speaking of silliness, Lehman wrote the script because, as you said, they wanted to make the ultimate Hitchcock film. He wanted to make the Hitchcockiest Hitchcock film he could. But Hitchcock also, after Vertigo, wanted to make something light. There's no dense themes. There's nothing to read into. He just wanted to make a fun film.
Not just Vertigo, but The Wrong Man. A couple years before Vertigo, was also a very serious film. Henry Fonda, the one time he worked with Hitchcock, was in The Wrong Man. And that movie is not funny, and that movie's not fun. Hitchcock generally was. Even in some of his serious dramas, he was pretty fun. Rear Window has some fun elements to it. Not laugh-out-loud, hilarious comedy, but some light moments.
Definitely. And Cary Grant is joking through the most dire crises.
Yeah.
He always is light. He always has a funny, silly thing to say. It's just kind of a silly movie.
Well, even at the end, where they're hanging off the edge of the monument... Literally a cliffhanger. He's got a wisecrack for that, where it's the previous wife thought he led to tell a lie.
Yeah, yeah. He has a silly line for everything.
Mm-hmm. All right, so that's the ending. We're near the beginning of the podcast, but let's talk about the ending already. One of at least three famous set pieces from this movie, the UN sequence. Yep. Obviously the crop duster sequence.
Oh, yeah.
And at the end, Mount Rushmore. Now, most of that was a set, because much like the Lincoln's Nose thing, they wouldn't let them call the movie that, but they also wouldn't let them shoot on it, because they couldn't have guns and violence and bloodshed and all that on the actual monument. And it would have been tough to do that logistically anyway.
Oh, yeah, just too dangerous.
Because anybody could have fallen and gotten hurt. Even the stuntmen could have died, let alone the actual actors up there. But it's pretty convincing, the set that they came up with. And this movie was nominated for its sets. The UN set was recreated. They got a shot of Cary Grant going into it. And as I pointed out to you during the movie, something I read online anyway, so a bit of a cheat, but there's a guy who does a double take of Cary Grant. It's just a hidden camera in a van.
Yeah, because they didn't have permission to shoot even the outside of the building.
So the guy looks at him, isn't that the guy who was in To Catch a Thief and all his other movies? To Catch a Thief for Hitchcock. Grant had been in with Grace Kelly a few years before this.
And the UN building is one of three major American landmarks that are in the film. The UN building and Mount Rushmore obviously are big parts of the film, but you see the Capitol building when through the window in the CIA.
Yeah,
there's lots of Americana in the film, which I guess makes sense for a film about the Cold War and about spies trying to mess with America.
And there's the thing, we just said a minute ago that he wanted to make a lighter film, but there are some deep elements in this movie. The CIA operatives, when they find out that Roger Thornhill, this advertising executive, has been mistaken for this non-existent George Kaplan person.
Yeah, that they only created to throw the spies off the track.
And when they find out that he's been mistaken for this guy, they don't even care. They don't even blink, especially the main guy.
They have a conversation about it, and then they basically agree that bad luck for him. Crummy for him. I guess good luck. Maybe he'll make it, maybe he won't.
And the professor, who's played by Leo G. Carroll, is truly Machiavellian in that way.
Mm-hmm.
And probably is realizing in that early scene, okay, if he dies, okay, but we actually probably can use this later. And of course, later on he does.
Mm-hmm.
We also learn later he's manipulating Eve.
Yeah, he's put Eve in a very dangerous position as well.
And another Hitchcock blonde who's cool and icy.
Yes.
Not nearly as cool and icy as Kim Novak was in Vertigo and some of the other Hitchcock films that he did that aren't on the list, actually. But much like in Vertigo, she's treated kind of badly by the hero. Now, in this case, it's understandable because Thornhill doesn't know that she's a double agent. And when he finds out that she is, he actually takes the professor to task. Maybe you gotta go on losing a few cold walls rather than putting women in this position.
What a gentleman.
Yeah, and there's not a lot of actual overt politics. No. I don't think they ever use the word commie in this movie, in a movie that's clearly about communists.
Oh, yeah, that's true. They just stay away from it.
Whenever you say Cold War, that implies, even if it's in the Russians, you're implying that
it's communists. As though they're just spies so that the villains have a motive and resources. Because just like Vertigo, it's guilty of having this insanely convoluted plot. Mm-hmm. Especially if you really go back and think about the beginning, where they have somehow taken advantage of a UN ambassador's empty house. Mm-hmm. Why is that house empty? Why are they getting away with that? Where do they find all these people to be such convincing actors and convince the police that Thornhill is making the whole thing up? Them pulling that off is a little hard to believe.
Maybe because it's so hard to believe that no one's ever going to believe it. Is that the right answer we're looking for here?
But the police believe it. We have to believe that the police believe this unbelievable lie.
The believability of the unbelievable of the blah, blah, blah. We said that Lehman's intention was to make the ultimate Hitchcock film, so then you've got to go with the mistaken identity of an innocent man who's been put in grave danger.
Yeah.
Classic example of that here.
There's lots more stuff, like you already mentioned. You've got the icy, classy blonde who aggressively pursues a man who's half the age
who
of the
propositions
male
him as well.
Yeah, exactly.
With a censored line where she says, "I never discuss love on an empty stomach," but she's clearly actually mouthing, "I never make love on an empty stomach."
Yeah, so we've got our icy blonde, and then we have our male lead who's twice her age, and he's a man with a dynamic career. We never see him at work, really, except for the very beginning he's leaving work, and he's drastically removed from his comfort zone. You have characters with more than one name. Thornhill is also called Kaplan, and you have Philip Van Damme pretending to be Lester Townsend.
Yeah.
And then the mystery, a lead character who's compelled to solve this mystery that's kind of put upon them. It's an impossibly elaborate mystery. Very Hitchcock.
You also have things that he used in some of his later movies, at least his next movie, that would be Mother Issues. Because much like in Psycho, you've got a mother who's a little hard to deal with. At least this mother is witty. Mm-hmm. Jesse Royce Landis is very funny. Another thing you've got is comparisons to two previous films of his, very directly. One is The 39 Steps. The other one is Notorious. Now let's go with Notorious. The lead woman sleeps with both characters. It's implied that she's been with Van Damme in that way, and it's pretty obvious she was with Thornhill, and of course she marries him, so she's very much with him at that point in the film. Notorious, the whole point of that film is that Cary Grant, again, who plays an agent for the government, is in love with Ingrid Bergman's character, who's been pimped out by the government, Cary Grant being part of that, to romance Claude Rains, his bad guy character. Mm-hmm. So allusions to that film. The 39 Steps thing is that you've got spies and the falsely accused man who goes on the run. But Hitchcock is kind of referencing himself, but at least taking it in new directions.
He loved these plots. He loved these themes. He goes back to them over and over.
And unlike in Rear Window, which is set in one place, and in Vertigo, which moves around through a lot of San Francisco, but it stagnates at a slow pace, this one moves.
Yeah.
I mean, it literally does, and it figuratively does. It's almost Planes, Trains, and Automobiles as well.
They must have had to do way more location shooting than he was comfortable with, because he hated location shooting.
Except the scene towards the end when Roger and Eve meet up, and now he finally knows who she truly is in the Pine Forest.
That's a set.
That was a set.
Yeah.
But still, there's an awful lot of stuff out there. The other most famous scene in this whole movie is the crop dusting sequence.
Oh, yeah, let's talk about
that. Now, that clearly is out there in the middle of nowhere. Yeah. There are plenty of process shots. This movie is actually a very technically interesting film. There's a lot of front screen projection in that, and probably rear screen as well. When I first became a film fan, I always wondered, why would they put anybody, let alone Cary Grant, in such danger of being run over by that plane? As a new burgeoning film fan who knew a little bit about movies, I still fell for the illusion that this plane was actually swooping in and almost shooting at him.
It's incredibly convincing.
Yeah.
You don't see the strings at all.
Well, you do in elements of it, because towards the end, when the plane actually hits that truck...
Oh, yeah, that's a motion effect.
If they'd done that a little differently, it might have been believable that he's running towards the tanker and the plane's trying for that last swoop to get him and just can't avoid the tanker, but it looks like the plane deliberately does it. And of course, there's no way these guys are going on a suicide run, especially into the gas tank of the truck to blow themselves up. And people have pointed out, too, that why are the bullets coming after the plane's gone by? But there would be a gunner. I think the implication is the gunner is shooting behind as the plane's gone by.
Oh, okay.
But the crop dusting thing is fantastic, and it's set up so well because you've got that really high shot. Hitchcock used the God's Eye point of view, or at least the high shot point of view, a lot in this movie. We see it early on when he first meets Van Damme, who's pretending to be Townsend in the library, or the study, I guess it is. Certainly we see it in the crop dusting sequence that establishes that he's out in the middle of nowhere. He gets off this bus, he sees one other guy, thinks he's the contact, thinks he's George Kaplan, realizes he's not. Yeah. But that guy is the one who says early
on,
that plane is crop dusting where there ain't no crops.
The way that scene is set up is great because he's looking as each of these cars go by and they really draw it out. Hmm. And when they set it up so well that when that one car stops and the guy gets out, you're sure this is the guy. And it's just the last thing in the world that you would expect would be a plane. It's a shame because everybody's so familiar with this scene, so everyone's just waiting for that plane to come chase him. But I can imagine if somebody saw this film without that being spoiled for them, what a great surprise it would be for that plane to just turn around and start coming straight for him. Such a cool little touch.
There are a few more elements of that sequence I really want to talk about. One is you never see the pilot in the crop duster.
No, I know you don't.
Which is something that Spielberg did in Duel. You never see the trucker. And then Joyride, a movie that was made an homage to Duel many years later. You don't ever see the trucker in that film either. And it's a pretty clever move. Apparently it's supposed to be that they're Van Damme's goons, one of whom you saw earlier and then you never saw him again. It's never explained. But there's that smart element to it. This pilot, you don't know who it really is.
It's kind of sinister. It's even more dark that way.
And there's also no music during that sequence. And that's something Hitchcock wanted to do for the shower scene in Psycho. He wanted that to play with no music. And in the documentary on the DVD, they show the sequence with no music. It's definitely very effective. It might have been almost as horrifying, but that shrieking music, that oft-imitated music in Psycho, amplifies it that much more. But here is an example of where he didn't use music, and he's got Bernard Herrmann doing the music yet again, but the sound effects of that drone of the plane, and it's the gunfire. But here's the last thing I want to say about the crop duster sequence. One of those refrigerator moments, as Hitchcock liked to call them. Why would they bother dusting anything?
I totally thought of that, too. Why was he dusting it? The guy's there.
Take the plane out, wait till he's by himself, because you know he's going to be at some point, and then just go after him and shoot him and kill him.
Yeah.
But anyway, that's one of those things that Hitchcock liked to call those refrigerator moments, because you only think about them later on, or I think they called it icebox moments back in the 50s, actually. Yeah. You only think about it when you're at the icebox late at night. You think, but why did he? Why did she? Why did they? Yeah, one of those wait-a-minute moments. But in any case, this is a great sequence and one of the most classic and oft imitated, certainly in TV shows. We've mentioned The Simpsons so often in this podcast, and that's supposed to have explained Marge's fear of flying, at least early on, that she was shot at too. And you definitely have to talk about this part. I said there was the last thing I want to say. Well, here's one more other thing I want to say, which is there's nothing but just prairie flatland except some corn. And then even when he thinks he's at least disguised by that, down comes the actual DDT. Well, you can't hide there after all. Where are you going to go, buddy boy? So getting back to Roger himself, advertising executive in Manhattan. Early in the movie, he has that nice little rat-a-tat with his secretary. We don't see her again. You can tell that he's a big man in his company, and he means something in that sense, but his life doesn't have a whole lot of meaning if he's just doing that. It's not as important as working for the government, which is what the movie ends up being about.
Yeah, he's a twice-divorced ad exec in Manhattan.
And several bartenders to take care of as well. But he's arguably better off as George Kaplan than he was as Roger Thornhill, because his life does have meaning. In the train scene with Eve, he says the O, Roger O. Thornhill. The O stands for nothing, which is two things. It's a play on David O. Selznick. The O in Selznick's name meant nothing as well.
Oh,
and Hitchcock had worked with Selznick early in his career, didn't like him, as he did with everybody, interfered with Hitchcock too much, in Hitchcock's opinion at least. But the other thing for me is that he's saying, indirectly saying at least, I don't mean anything. What am I doing? I'm kind of pointless. And that brings up the comparisons to a very famous TV series, which just ended its first half of its seventh season. And that's, of course, Mad Men, which was started around the same time as when this movie was made.
It started 1 year after this movie
1960.
Was released.
Okay. But here are the comparisons in a very direct way. The main character is named Roger. Now, it's Don in Mad Men, but a major character is
Roger.
You've got the fact that he's an ad man in the first place. Women throw themselves at him like they do with Don Draper.
Totally.
Even that great moment is one of the funniest moments of the whole movie that, Stop!
In the hospital.
When she puts on the glasses and sees who he really is. Cary Grant. Oh, stop and stay here. He's impeccably dressed. The very famous suit that he wears through pretty much
dapper.
The entire movie.
Which is apparently considered the greatest suit. It was voted somehow by somebody. The best suit in all of cinema history. I guess I don't know suits very well. Or not well enough to have noticed the magnificence of this suit. But apparently it was copied in a couple of movies. The one I'm thinking of is Collateral. That suit.
A gray
that,
suit, yeah.
The gray suit is a perfect copy of that suit. Maybe not perfect, because nothing's as perfect as the suit in North by Northwest.
Early in the movie, when he's being plied with, what is it that they put into his mouth?
Bourbon, right?
Bourbon. Whole bottle of bourbon.
Yeah.
You said, why do they pour the bourbon into the glass?
Oh, it was just so that they could show the
audience. The effect of, you're going to give you this entire thing. Which means he probably would have been unconscious or maybe even vomiting everywhere. He should probably be covering his own vomit, but
incidentally, let me make my one biggest complaint about this film. Cary Grant cannot play a drunk. I felt embarrassed for him.
You said that during the sequence where he's driving, all that stuff, I agree with you. But I think in this scene, when he's at the police station and he calls his mother, It's more comedic than it is believable.
But that's a funny scene.
That's a good scene.
You play that though, with that vaudevillian style. You play that like Chaplin. You don't play the scene where they're trying to kill you and your life is in danger. When he's at the wheel and he's just rolling his eyes and rolling his head and all over the place like a rag doll. Drunk people don't act like that.
Especially if you know that your life is in danger, which even though he's blasted, he obviously knows that.
I remember I had an acting instructor once tell me that the best way to play a drunk is to play a person doing their damnedest to not appear drunk. Because that's what drunk people actually do.
I've been there many times.
Sure.
In front of your parents or a friend or somebody says, you're drunk, aren't you?
He's drunk right now.
I'm not drunk. You can usually hear it in someone's voice. I'm often loaded in these podcasts. As is Fox. He likes to drink a lot. He's a drunk dog. Alcoholic dog. But the last thing I want to say about the Mad Men thing is, was Roger headed for an ego-driven, solipsistic existence as a Mad Men-esque executive until this mystery falls in his lap?
See, I think that Hitchcock would laugh at people like you and I trying to read more into this film than what is actually there.
He probably would.
Lehman and Hitchcock told people, stop looking for symbolism. In North by Northwest, it's not there.
Well, we're going to keep on doing it because there's a lot of symbolism to look at because it's one of our movies. Well, here's another piece of symbolism because like Jack Lemmon in Some Like It Hot last week, Cary Grant embraces being someone he's not. It's funny how he's always resistant to being George Kaplan early on. I'm not George Kaplan. But then he actually calls himself that a few times, of course, because he has to. Then it makes it logical when he goes to the fake Kaplan's hotel room and he calls down to the front desk and he actually says, I'm George Kaplan.
Mm-hmm.
And then he becomes this secret agent that he never really was supposed
to be. Well, he gets drawn into the mystery. There's no doubt about that. And he gets drawn into the imaginary life of Kaplan.
Right.
Kaplan, if he were a person, would lead a very exciting life, right?
Yeah. A Bond-like life.
Yeah, exactly.
But like Jack Lemmon, he embraces something that he originally pushes against.
Yeah, initially he resists it.
Doesn't seem to come naturally to him originally, but then certainly does through the course of the story. We talk about subtext. Hitchcock may resist this, but there's gay subtext between Martin Landau and James Mason. Landau has lines like, my woman's intuition.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
And that kind of thing. So Mason and Landau's characters are supposed to have been intimate. It's not blatant, but it's certainly subtle enough. And we said last week with Some Like a Heart, we're going to have this subtext in a lot of our upcoming movies.
Their relationship kind of mimics the boss and thug relationship that we saw in Maltese Falcon and Third Man. And in both those cases, the gay subtext was much more overt.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe it's just mimicking that trope in cinema that bad guys are maybe a little gay.
Martin Landau complained at one point that Hitchcock wasn't giving him direction. So when Hitchcock would say cut, he would talk to Cary Grant, he would talk to James Mason, he would talk to Eva Marie Saint, wouldn't talk to Landau.
Mm-hmm.
What am I doing wrong? What am I doing wrong? Hitchcock later told him, that's a compliment. If I'm not telling you anything, keep on doing what you're doing.
Yeah, you're doing it right.
Yeah. And the last thing I want to talk about as far as text or subtext goes is you've got the government just using these people.
Yeah.
Using Eve Kendall as this double agent. Putting her life in danger.
Mm-hmm.
Using Roger.
Yeah,
someone who has nothing to do with this
whatsoever.
Who absolutely didn't want to be a part of this. Mm-hmm. But it is the Cold War. So they're willing to let people die so they can supposedly save America.
Not like now, right?
And as far as text goes, something you really can't get around would be the sexuality in this movie. There's a fair amount of that. There's the long kiss on the train. Is interrupted by conversation, much like a Notorious.
Well, they first started getting intimate with their conversation in the dining car.
Mm-hmm.
When there's innuendo aplenty, this guy who's running for his life, and there's cops on the train looking for him, but he straightens his tie and...
puts on those dark glasses. No one recognizes me with these dark glasses.
Even though you're the only person wearing sunglasses on the train.
But I guess the biggest sexuality... Then this is subtext, but kind of text. The very last shot of the movie.
Yeah.
When they've been married and they're in the train compartment and you know what's about to happen and the train goes through the tunnel. And apparently Hitchcock thought that was one of the greatest things he ever shot.
It's so funny. Hitchcock was so obsessed with sex.
He really was.
Imagine if he was making films today. I can't.
I said during Vertigo, if he could have shown Stewart and Novak actually flat out shagging, he would have done it.
Oh, yeah. He did love those moments. He lingers on those moments. And that last shot is sexual, but it's really more of a wink. It's more of a joke.
A wink, wink, sure.
Yeah. And they just got married. They're on their honeymoon. Of course they're going to have sex. Like, you don't need to remind us, but he does. It's just the punchline. It's like the rim shot of the movie.
Lehman says on the documentary something like, that was Hitchcock's idea. Damn it.
That's great.
I think I read somewhere that Hitchcock gave him three main themes. They were supposed to have done something else together called The Wreck of the Merry Deer, which somebody else directed later on. They didn't like that project, and that's when they came up with this one. And the main themes were supposed to be the UN sequence where someone dies at the UN, the Mount Rushmore ending, and then I think the crop duster sequence, but he had three or four, at the most, ideas, and then build from that. And then this guy came up with this original screenplay. So many things that Hitchcock did were adapted from books.
That's right.
All right, so let's go over the resumes of these people here. Cary Grant, this is the last time we're going to talk about him. His final of third AFIers here. This is his first one since The Philadelphia Story, which was 30 AFI movies ago. He could have had His Girl Friday or Notorious, which I've already mentioned plenty on this list, but they didn't make that cut. He was 55 when they did this movie.
Yeah.
He only made a half dozen more before he retired, and he was the one that started feeling a little uncomfortable about playing these kinds of characters. Where he's got his shirt off in that sequence, the stop, stop. Just before that, we see him with his shirt off. He looks okay. He looks great, actually, for a 55-year-old man.
Yeah, but he looks like a 55-year-old man.
But much like Jimmy Stewart, starting to look a little bit of his age. Now, we said a few weeks ago that Jimmy Stewart wanted to play Roger Thornhill quite badly in this movie, but Hitchcock always wanted Grant for the role.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing about Grant I always admired, actually, now that I look back at it, like John Wayne, like the Duke, like Sean Connery, never changing that voice, and Michael Caine, they always sound the same. They just use their normal voice in every movie. Some differences. I think Grant played a Cockney at one point, but you kind of have to admire that. He sounds like he's from some part of England, and yet he's supposed to be a Manhattan advertising executive.
Yeah.
Eva Marie Saint. This is her second and final AFIer. She, of course, was in On the Waterfront with Brando. She was also in Exodus and Superman Returns. I think she's better in this than she was in On the Waterfront, where she won the Supporting Actress Oscar.
I think everybody thinks that. All the vintage reviews I read talked about how Hitchcock found a depth in her that no other director had accomplished.
And she shows that hurt when she's slammed by Thornhill, who doesn't know what she's really doing and what her real role is in this. She's come to fall for this guy who doesn't know that she's not really just some skank who's using him and abusing his trust and sleeping with him.
Luring him to his
death. And yet being a bad guy, maybe luring him to his death. She shows that without making it obvious to him, but certainly making it clear to us. And she also can play cool, she can play sexy, she's certainly a good-looking blonde.
Oh, yeah.
Apparently, Grant and even the studio wanted Sophia Loren to have played Eve Kendall. And I love Sophia Loren, and talk about beautiful and gorgeous. But she might have been hard to believe as a spy, because she's a little bit too sexy. They could have dressed her down, I suppose, but I don't know.
I don't know. Aren't sexy spies a thing? Haven't you ever seen any Bond movie? All spies are exceptionally sexy.
Sometimes that's the weak part of the movie. Some of these characters who are absurd, who would never have been what they're supposed to be in those movies.
I'm not sure if I should be, like, comforted that my husband just said that, or maybe a little worried. I don't know. Do the spies need to be that sexy?
You can be worried, comforted, both at the same time. And speaking of the studio, I said they wanted Loren. Apparently, they also wanted Gregory Peck to have played Roger. He would have been a good choice. I don't know if Stewart would have been a great choice, despite the fact he wanted it so badly. Peck and Loren might have been fun. But Grant and Saint were the right ones, I think, in the end. Agreed?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. I loved them both. Except for the drunk scene.
Okay, the supporting cast. James Mason. This is his only AFI film. He was in many fine films. 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea, where he plays Captain Nemo. Star is Born, that movie's been made many times, but that may be the best version, he and Judy Garland. Lolita, where he plays Humbert Humbert.
That's why I recognized him.
Right, and he has a supporting role in The Verdict, the Paul Newman movie, but he's very good as a sort of bad guy lawyer. He's on the wrong side, but he's fair. He's a very great actor, and it's unfortunate we're not going to see him again. He's very sly in this movie, too, and they dress him well. Of course, Hitchcock's character is almost always well-dressed.
He's such a choice villain.
Right, and if he and Landau's characters are supposed to be involved emotionally and sexually and whatever else, he doesn't give that away. Although it's interesting that if they are supposed to be, that when Landau gets shot and killed at the end of the movie and falls off Mount Rushmore, what's his reaction?
Not very sporting.
And he seems to be indifferent at the time it happens, too.
Do you really think that there's a gay subtext between those two characters?
That's what I've read it's supposed to be. Landau's got a few lines about it.
Yeah?
Yeah. I never picked up on it, I'll admit
it's
that.
It's pretty subtle if it's there.
Yeah, well, maybe that's why they did it that way, because it is still 1959.
Yeah.
And speaking of Martin Landau, Miss Women's Intuition, this is his second movie ever. Not bad, and getting no direction from Hitchcock in a good way. He has been in the business for a long time. Crimes and Misdemeanors, Ed Wood replays Bela Lugosi, won the Oscar for that, and was in Mission Impossible on TV, but he doesn't have a ton of great credits despite his long career. I like him when he's in movies like those. But he's got a lot of other kind of duds. I liked him in Rounders, small role in that. But a good actor, and he does a fine job in this movie as a sinister villain. Not a lot of lines. Most of his lines were towards the end of the film when they're in that South Dakota chalet.
He discovered that Eve is a turncoat.
Jesse Royce Landis, who plays Cary Grant's mother in this movie, despite being only 8 years older than he is.
Oh, my God. He's a girlfriend half his age and a mom 8 years older than him.
She does look a lot older than he does. But
well, they dress her old, right?
That's part of it, yeah. She was also in Hitchcock's To Catch a Thief with Grant, and she was in Airport. And as I said before, she's very witty and charming, and she accepts bribes from her own son.
Yeah, that's
right. It's too bad that she and the secretary are gone so early in the movie, because even though the movie's got some witty moments, those three and their incarnations, the secretary and Grant and his mother, are almost a vaudevillian act. They're very funny together.
They're so funny, yeah.
Leo G. Carroll plays the professor. He was also in Wuthering Heights for us a long time ago. And he was in Hitchcock's Rebecca and Strangers on a Train. Did a good job of playing an empty suit, which is what Thornhill was, I guess you could say, in his previous job. Or, well, still his job. These may be small roles, but we've seen these guys before, so I will mention them. Edward Binns plays a detective really early in the movie. And he was also in 12 Angry Men as the painter.
Mm-hmm.
And Philip Ober, who is in From Here to Eternity. He was also in Elmer Gantry with Burt Lancaster. And From Here to Eternity, he played Holmes, the guy who was so hard on Montgomery Clift's character and was trying to make
the
him
become
a boxer. And then he ends up getting, in the book, From Here to Eternity, gets promoted. In the movie, he is demoted. Forced to resign, I think, in fact. But he's Townsend, who gets knifed in the back at the UN.
Oh, yeah.
A really well-played moment. They show the guy taking pictures of just random people in there. When Grant first starts talking to Townsend, they have a bit of a conversation. Grant says, "Do you recognize this man?" Oh! And then it's the knife in the back. And because there's somebody taking pictures, he turns around and sees Grant holding the knife. It may be slightly contrived, but it's actually very clever.
Even more contrived than the crop dusting plane, dusting no crops. Who in their right mind takes a knife out of a murder victim's back?
Yes, and who in the right mind believes that he would do that right there? And did no one see that he didn't actually stab the guy? But again, refrigerator moment. I think in the heat of that moment, you think, oh my God, he's red-handed. He's holding the weapon. They got a picture of him right then and there.
The pace is fast enough and it's fun enough and you're caught up enough at that point that you forgive it.
And I think, and this may be an excuse by layman Hitchcock and me being an apologist right now, but you can almost say that they are winking at us. They know that that's absurd. Why would anybody fall for that? But like you said, keep the pace going. Mm-hmm. No one's going to dwell on that moment until you do a review like this later on and say, but what about, and that, and this?
Mm-hmm.
But that is our job. Okay, well, Hitchcock, the third movie he's made on the list so far, Rear Window and Vertigo were before this. He's got Psycho coming in a few weeks. We do three of his movies, and I think it's 6 weeks. In fact, we have a stretch where it's Hitchcock, Wilder, Hitchcock, Wilder, Wilder, Hitchcock.
Oh, really?
Well, don't forget, I said Wilder. That's Ben-Hur.
Oh, right.
But those three names are the only ones that appear for about 6 weeks of our movies.
And this will happen in the 70s again with Spielberg and Coppola and... and George Lucas and Harrison, we're going to see tons of Harrison Ford.
Right.
By the late 70s, early
80s. Ford is in all three of their movies at one time or another. Yeah. Three directors.
Yeah. But they really did dominate when it comes to quality films. Obviously, they weren't the only people, but they did dominate that period of time. And I guess that was true for Billy Wilder and Hitchcock and Wyler.
This is one of the elements about us doing this chronologically, is that you come up with these interesting streaks.
Yeah.
We can't control that. That's when the movies were made.
Yeah, you can kind of imagine what it was like to enjoy these films when they came out. That was the whole point. And at the time when it came out, Hitchcock was the thing, and everybody was probably jazzed about the new Hitchcock film coming out every couple of years, you know, the way people get excited about the new David O. Russell film now.
And Hitchcock had three classic movies in three consecutive years, 58, 59, 60, Vertigo, this one, and Psycho. Hitchcock was 60 when they shot this movie, or almost 60, I guess. I mentioned Cary Grant was 55, so those two guys were not young men anymore. I guess you could call this his peak years, because he made this classic film, even though it wasn't thought of it that way at the time. Psycho was coming, The Birds was coming, and this was coming out. Huge success. 60 years old, almost retirement age. That's pretty impressive. Not that shocking for a director. That happens with other directors, too. But still, pretty impressive for this guy to have made all these movies before that, many of them great when he was 40 or even 50. And now here he is, this age, still making these kinds of movies.
If by your 60s you still have the energy to be a film director, then you combine the experience that you have and also the clout with the studios, and you can make your best work, I think.
I think you're probably right about that. This was his only MGM film, and it was a huge comeback after the perceived failure of Vertigo. Perceived because, of course, long-term, it certainly hasn't been considered a failure, and it did break even.
It was perceived as a failure because Hitchcock films normally did so well.
Spielberg-esque.
Yeah, exactly.
But he didn't work with MGM before or after this movie. As we've said many times, it was written by Ernest Lehman, who has an interesting run starting here. He's got four AFIers, West Side Story, Sound of Music, Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, and obviously North by Northwest. He also wrote Sweet Smell of Success, which we've talked about so often, we'll say it again, and Hitchcock's final film, Family Plot. It's interesting that they got along pretty well, it sounds like they did at least, and didn't work together again. Which is a bit of a surprise. You think that Hitchcock would be trying to draft him for future screenplays. But Lehman's credits are interesting because you've got the two musicals in there, and you've got this action film. an action-adventure film, and then Virginia Woolf, of course, is four people in a room.
Mm-hmm. All three of those movies are also based on plays.
So he adapted those, yeah. Lehman was nominated for 6 Oscars, 4 for writing, 2 were for producing, but he only won an honorary award in 2001. And looking back at his credits when I was doing the research for this movie, I'm thinking he's one of the better writers of that era. Absolutely sure, way yeah. up there. And the producers were Hitchcock himself, as we said on Vertigo, he was his own producer by this point, and his associate producer, Herbie Coleman. Since this film is so technical, let's talk about that for a bit. Another VistaVision movie, much like Vertigo was. We watched the Blu-ray, bought that a few years ago. I think it's a pretty good print. Almost flawless, I would say.
I agree.
One thing I've read many times before, and I've looked for this the last few times I've watched the movie, is that apparently Roger is almost always on the left side of the frame. And if you look at that, certainly in the major scenes, he at least starts on the left-hand side of the frame. Maybe that's the choice of your eyes are drawn to the left side, like you would when you're reading.
Yeah, that is true. That's why in horror films, the dangerous thing always comes from the right, if you're trying to alarm your audience.
Yeah, because it throws them off. Mm-hmm. But it's interesting you can make a movie this long and keep that motif, for the most part, where he's on the left-hand side of the screen, to always frame him that way. Great planning. Mm. There's the storyboards come into effect.
But that's also, Hitchcock, he's so meticulous and that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. That's really where his strength always is.
Pre-production was the key for him, yeah. more than from almost anybody else.
And staging, mise-en-scène, you know, those little details are what set his films apart.
His cinematographer was Robert Burks, yet again. He also did Rear Window and Vertigo and Strangers on a Train for Hitchcock, The Birds for Hitchcock, and The Wrong Man for Hitchcock. They worked together a bunch of times, and those are some classic titles. The editor, once again, George Tomasini, worked on 9 Hitchcock films, including his 4 AFIs, and he also did Stalag 17 for Wilder and Cape Fear, the original Cape Fear. The music, we haven't said that much about Bernard Herrmann on this one like we did on Vertigo, but it's another classic score. He did Citizen Kane, North by Northwest, Psycho, Vertigo, Taxi Driver, and also did the music for Cape Fear and The Day the Earth Stood Still. Those first 4 or 5, I said, were AFI films. This movie, unlike Vertigo, which has that hypnotic and the sense of dread, in this case, it's jaunty and fun.
Yeah, yeah, it's very dynamic and fantastic. I loved it. It completely adds to the film. It's I never considered myself a Bernard Herrmann fan before, but the more that we're watching these films and talking about him in the podcast, I am becoming so.
Well, also because he does it so differently each time. Citizen Kane was known for the woodwinds. Vertigo had that hypnotic sort of spiraling. You can almost feel the spiraling mm-hmm. that happens in that movie. This one is that driving force, but fun way of doing it. Psycho, we all know about the infamous shrieking of the shower
it's
scene.
It's barely music. It's almost a sound effect, but it is mm-hmm. music.
And then in Taxi Driver, he's got 2 main themes that we'll certainly talk about when we get to that film, too. So his resume is as complete as anybody else. As much as I like other composers, he's just so damn good. Apparently, Herrmann was the one who introduced Hitchcock and Lehman.
Oh, no kidding.
He put them in the room together, which was obviously a great move on his part. And here's a fun fact I didn't mention on Vertigo. Herrmann was never nominated for a score for a Hitchcock film.
What was he nominated
for? He only got 5 nominations ever. And he only ever won once.
Well, it's 5 more nominations than I have.
But still, you think about all the nominations that John Williams has had, and he's a great film composer.
5 nominations for anybody who works in film.
Well, it's great, but he had so many scores that weren't recognized. It's hard to believe, looking back. But then Hitchcock wasn't recognized. At least his pictures weren't recognized. He was as a director several times, but not as often for the movies themselves.
Yeah.
The other thing that plays up so well in the beginning of this movie are the titles. Saul Bass, who did it for Vertigo, and he did it for Psycho. And for Spartacus, we've got that pretty soon. West Side Story, which is not long after Spartacus. Goodfellas, which is quite a ways in our future. He did 6 AFI movies in total, in fact. In this case, his titles start out on the sides of the skyscrapers with that music playing. Mm-hmm. Which is homaged in, I think it's homaged at least, in 2 movies in 2002, Panic Room and Spider-Man, which both have their titles playing out over skyscrapers in New York. Of course, both those movies are set in New York. Mm-hmm. The sets, by the way, are Robert Boyle. He did Cape Fear, we've said this yet again. He did The Birds, Marnie, and In Cold Blood. Nice little resume there for him. Different kinds of films, color, black and white. And he and his collaborators were nominated for this film for their various sets. The Mount Rushmore, the UN, and many other places.
Deserve it. It's really well done.
Yeah. All right, there's quite a bit of influence. I think we've said some of them already. 39 Steps thing where Hitchcock is homaging himself. Notorious, where he plays into some of the same themes he plays into here. The crop duster sequence, imitated so often in pop culture, has become iconic. Hitchcock has, I don't know, maybe 10 or 15 even scenes or sequences that are famous in pop culture and have been homaged in so many other movies and TV shows and everything. But the crop duster sequence is way up there as far as one of the best ones and the most recognized ones.
It's probably the first images you would think of if you wanted to conjure Hitchcock as a director.
It encapsulates him pretty well.
Yeah.
Especially if you want to think of him as an action director, at least in this case. Another homage I think you could say would be Catch Me If You Can. The music is not quite the same, but it's sort of like it is in North by Northwest, and the opening title is kind of that of the theme, and just the way the movie plays out. I think that was Spielberg's attempt to try to be Hitchcock, was Catch Me If You Can. And it's a pretty solid film. We said before the iconic suit, where Adam Sandler wearing only one suit in A Punch Drunk Love, was apparently a deliberate homage by PTA, Paul Thomas Anderson, to have him wearing that one blue suit in the entire film. We do see Cary Grant in a couple of different suits in this movie, mostly the one gray suit, but that was a reference. Typically is the case for these famous AFI films, lots of TV shows have parodied the movie in one way or another. The three award nominations, didn't win any of them, but it got nominated for an Oscar for the screenplay, the editing, and the sets. Lehman, Tomasini, Boyle, and his people all were the nominations but didn't win out. Two of those losses were to Ben-Hur, our film next week.
Yes.
The editing and the sets. The movie made the National Film Registry in 1995, and the two AFI recognitions were, it was 7th in the mystery category in the top 100 genres, and it was 4th in the top 100 thrills. I remember when I saw the thrill show, I was waiting for what the top 10 were going to be, and I was mildly surprised by that. I'd forgotten it hadn't been picked already.
I think it belongs there. It's a great action movie.
The number one thrill, by the way, was Psycho.
Ah, see, I'm always surprised. Because they never know how to necessarily categorize that film.
Yeah.
Because it's not quite a horror, but it's not a mystery. It kind of borrows all these different components.
It does.
But we'll talk about that when we get to Psycho.
Not too long from now, only a few weeks away. All right, parting thoughts on North by Northwest.
It's such a thoroughly enjoyable film. It's probably not something I would pull off the shelf, but it's a film that once you get into it, it's delightful.
You didn't dread it at all, I'm sure, because you've seen that one
before,
right? I
don't ever dread watching Hitchcock, because Hitchcock, even if you don't like it, if you're a film fan, you can get something out of watching it because they're so dense with details, right? He's such a competent director. So as much as I'm not a Hitchcock fan and his films don't move me, I never dread watching one.
Okay. And you said before this is your favorite of his films.
Yeah, this is my favorite Hitchcock.
And it's certainly not my favorite, but it's a good one.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it belongs on the top 100 list. All right, up next on the Top 100 Project is a lumbering, gigantic, biblical epic, Ben-Hur.
Mm-hmm.
Our final William Wyler project, we haven't done him in a while, and our lone Charlton Heston title. So in that vein, the coming attraction trivia for Ben-Hur, Charlton Heston starred in only this one AFI film. How many of his far less famous co-stars were in more AFI films than he was? 1, 2, 4, or 6? And of course, if you can, please name them.
All right, so for the answer to that question, please tune into our podcast next week. And in the meantime, if you'd like more from Ryan and me, please visit our website, top100project.com. Don't forget to subscribe to the Top 100 Project on iTunes. You can also find us on Podomatic, top100project.podomatic.com. And what did you think of North by Northwest and any other film that Ryan and I have talked about? We'd love to hear from you. Please send us an email, top100projectpodcast@gmail.com.
You two took this too seriously. It's only a movie.
And cut.